and welcome to episode 80 of Must See Matches. I am Kieran Lefort, and joining me as always, the man behind Must See Matches, Mark Buckley. Mark, how's it going?
Yeah, I'm very good. And we'll talk about the weekend in a minute.
Yes, I guess we will. I want to quickly talk about, this is slightly something of a milestone. So we are, this is number 80, which is a nice round number. This means, including the match we're going to talk about today, we only have 25 Must See Matches left.
Yeah.
This is the first match of another bracket of percentage. I really need to find out, find a better way of phrasing that. We are in the 10.71% of nominations bracket.
Double figures, baby.
Is that the worst?
Not a very big bracket, but it's there. We should very quickly introduce, before he blows his cover and accidentally introduces himself, someone I'm starting to think is living in the walls of Must See Matches Towers. Eamon Bell is back again. Eamon, how are you?
I'm good, guys. Thanks. I heard this episode was about someone surly who listens to DMX. And so I thought, well, if they're going to be talking about me on the podcast anyway, I might as well. I might as well come on for it.
Tremendous. As Mark slightly hinted, he and I were in the same room at the same time this weekend just passed. We went to see RevPro at the 229. And in fact, sat with the wrestling fan all other wrestling fans know, Gadget Boy. Old Gadge has been around forever. He won't appreciate me saying that. Sorry, mate. he looks a lot younger than he actually is. Former guest Ian Hamilton was sat with us. We ended up in the front row, thanks to Ian spreading out coats and bags. And for the most part, saw a hell of a show, I thought, Mark.
Yeah, it was pretty good top to bottom. I wouldn't say there was anything... I mean,
there was nothing I called actively bad. There were a couple of things that disappointed me slightly.
Yeah.
But there were no stinkers. At no point did I think, oh, Jesus, I wish I was having a piss or at the bar during this match.
It's one of those shows where it's like in the first four matches, there was three of them where it's like, I have never seen anyone do this before. I'm not sure if it's a good idea half the time, but I've never seen anyone do this before.
There was a lot of, should we call it reckless innovation in some places? For example, has anybody ever seen a Quebrada, a lion salt countered with a flying headbutt in midair, for example? We did.
Yeah.
You can count on Shigehiro Irie. Yeah, I thought the first half was very good. And I think the second half is where the weak matches were. I wasn't fussed about the second tag match so much, mostly because it was the second go-go-go tag match of the night and the crowd were a bit tired for it. And it was quite sloppy compared to the first one where everything was really crisp.
And I'm pretty sure I'd never seen, is it True and Lacey?
Yes.
In the first one. And I was fairly impressed by them, other than the fact that they were doing high spotty stuff when they were clearly heels. But
I'm generally fine with that. And if Eamon wants to chime in, just so he's not sitting there in silence, I'm generally fine with that in the terms of like the show off heel. Look what I can do. I can do it better than the ones you like. Like, it's not necessarily about trying to get a cheer out of the crowd. It's just showing off. I have seen True and Lacey before. Bye, Mark. We'll see you in a minute. Oh, there you go.
I could have sworn I've got the fucking Ethernet cable plugged in.
All right. Do we need to stop for technical difficulties? Are you all right?
I'm just biding time. I'm just going to spend the same amount of time talking about all the Baldur's Gate 3 I played at the weekend. that'll be my first...
I haven't played any of that. I'm not a D&D person. I sort of know D&D like by osmosis and by proxy. Yeah. So my main friendship group, the one we all refer to as the hot one, is the nerdiest one of the lot of us. Like, he's an extremely handsome man who's covered in tattoos, but every weekend he's a DM. So I know like D&D through him, and I've done like a little one shot he did, like set in the Aliens universe, which was pretty fun.
Oh, nice. Yeah, yeah.
But that's like my only experience. And then during lockdown, I watched a lot of whatever the Rooster Teeth D&D show ended up being called, where they were just playing it over Zoom.
Yeah, yeah.
But I sit between two massive fucking D&D nerds at work, both of whom are playing Baldur's Gate.
As someone who was also a D&D nerd, like, it's great. I don't think you would need to be into D&D, though, to enjoy it.
Yeah.
Like, if you played, like, Knights of the Old Republic or something like that back in the day, like, as long as you were okay with that type of game and gameplay, yeah, then I would definitely recommend
it. Sure. Mark, you back?
Yep. Well, I'm almost I'm not on Wi-Fi. I'm on the Ethernet, so therefore that is my actual internet connection, not...
Cool. Awesome. We'll see how long that lasts. And I will also decide if what Aimed and I talked about is staying in or coming out.
What, the Baldur's Gate bit?
Yeah, the Baldur's Gate bit. I had seen True and Lacey before. They were the previously ill-advisedly named Teens with Attitude at whatever the shows I used to go to at Wimbledon Library were called. And they were fine. True was the guy who usually sold the lottery tickets, the raffle tickets. I thought that match was really good. I'm not a Lycos fan, really. And I think it's because, like, they kind of saturated the scene for a while. Like, they were everywhere.
Yeah.
One other or both of them was everywhere. But I'm annoyed to admit they're actually pretty good, and they meshed well with True and Lacey.
Mm.
The match we really should talk about, though, quickly, because we've got another match to get into, is most definitely the British heavyweight title match, which was Luke Jacobs versus Michael Oku. Leaving aside that it doesn't really fit Jacobs' story for him to have a title match and lose it at this point, the match itself, from start to finish, was half an hour of fantastic stuff.
Yeah. They're both probably two of the stronger workers on the British scene. And Jacobs is a guy that I've just loved watching, seeing him grow. Mm. Growing confidence, growing ability, developing style slightly. I think I first saw him... I first got my big impression of him at the third Tetsujin show against Ethan Allen. And that was one that got a lot of play around the time, because it was these two lads who were like under 22 or something stupid like that. Oh, yeah,
he's still absurdly young. I have T-shirts older than Luke Jacobs, I think.
Those two had a very similar match at like WXW as well during one of the Ambitions.
Yeah, that was the rematch of the Tetsujin one, so they did it as a kind of offer match kind of thing.
Yeah, because Chris Ridgway was booked, so I think he just brought them along basically for work experience or whatever. And,
and it says something that Luke Jacobs was the first person announced for the next 16-carat tournament, so that's the kind of level he's getting towards.
He was great this year. He did... the Ambition super fight against, oh gosh, Alexander Wolf, I think is his name now.
Yeah.
Who, used to be in Ringkampf. He's really, really great. And he's one of those guys where it feels like he's too good to just be in Europe. But him and Luke Jacobs just battered each other.
I have just looked, and Jacobs, as we record this, has only been 23 years old. For 2.5 months.
Yeah.
He should not be as good as he is. One of the things I liked was he was very much wearing his Stan Hansen influences on his sleeve.
Good.
I thought both of them put in a cracking performance. I don't want to go on about this show. I just thought it was worth mentioning, particularly because we were in the same place. Yeah. But I would say, I'm not going to call it must-see, because that kind of dents the ethos behind this show.
It waters down the brand.
Yeah. But I would say...
If you did a spin-off, strongly recommended matches.
Yes, strongly recommended matches. I would absolutely say Oku versus Jacobs. Let's say go out of your way to see Oku versus Jacobs. And if you happen to stumble over Lycos versus True and Lacey, Ricky Knight Jr. versus Shigehiro Irie, and I would also say the women's tag that was on the show, Danny Luna and Kanji versus Alex Windsor and Mercedes Blaze, I enjoyed a lot. That's 4 out of 8 that are worth your time. And the rest of the support, as we said, was not bad at all. There was some really, really great stuff on this show. It was well worth the £20 I spent on my ticket.
Yeah. And you enjoyed it despite me and my constant commentary of bullshit.
It was all highly entertaining. I did put a couple of pictures up, including one of what our seats used to be before Oku and Jacobs crashed into them. Poor Ian, his seat was squashed beyond repair, and he was sitting a good 2 to 3 inches lower than the rest of us for the rest of the show. Yeah, heck of a time. Great show. Loved it.
Just a quick one about you're saying about like Lycos guys being good, but maybe feeling a little overexposed.
Mm.
The last time I saw original Kid Lycos wrestle live was on an Eve show. So the all women's promotion had Kid Lycos booked.
All women plus one wolf.
Yeah, I showed up. I was like, okay, yeah, all women's show. And then Kid Lycos came out. And I was like, oh my God.
What surprised me about that team was I remember when he was the small one in the tag team.
Yeah.
Lycos 2 is tiny. I mean, I can only imagine Lycos 2 standing next to Chris Brooks, the ridiculous difference between those two. But yeah.
If you put Lycos 2 on Lycos 1's shoulders, is it as tall as Chris Brooks? Or do you think he still has a couple of inches?
What happens if you put a trench coat over them? Is that how they buy their booze? Right, we should get on with the match we're actually here to talk about. We've wasted 10 minutes already. We are talking about Bryan Danielson versus Kenta from Ring of Honor Glory by Honor 5, Day 2. September the 16th, 2006, Danielson is defending his Ring of Honor title here. I am hoping these two gentlemen have brought lots of background and context, because I was paratrooper again this week, as I am with a lot of this era of Ring of Honor, to be honest. Mark has already told me he's got some stuff prepared, so I'm going to throw it to him first. So kind of what can you tell me about like the going into this match? And Eamon, feel free to jump in and correct him or shut him up, or, you know, add further context as required.
So this was Bryan Danielson's infamous 2005-2006 ROH world title run. And I think in terms of Ring of Honor title runs, the only one that comes close is probably the Samoa Joe run.
Was this an attempt to sort of eclipse the Joe run?
Maybe that, but I think also a good part of it...
Wasn't that 03 to 05? And then here we are in 2006, and...
It's 03 to 04.
Right.
Joe like wins it like early 03, and he loses it on like the last show of 2004. So sure. It ends up being like 21, 22 months kind of.
Because yeah. I just remember the commentators here saying, you know, this weekend, if Danielson beats Kenta, this marks 1 year as champion.
Yeah. But he might have had more defenses than Joe.
Sure. Okay.
Yeah.
We'll get to that later on.
Yeah.
Yeah. But in terms of, as I say, with Danielson, this is his big run. And he has... The thing with Ring of Honor title matches, and I've said this before, was they were unafraid to have a lot of title defenses in a reign. And you'd often get weekends where you'd have two title matches back to back.
Yeah, they weren't necessarily doing one a month, were they, as you might see in other companies?
Yep. In fact, the last matches that Danielson had, which were nearly a month before this, because Danielson came out of with an injury, which was mentioned on commentary, he had two back-to-back 60-minute draws. So he had one on one day, and the next day he had another 60-minute draw.
Never takes the easy route, does he?
No. And this was something that he was doing a lot in his title reign, having these longer matches and that. And I think it was kind of him trying to prove himself, because there's the infamous story that him and Austin Aries wanted to do a 2.5 hour long 2 out of 3 falls match.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which luckily got condensed into only a 75 minute match.
Yes.
I think it's like this really interesting look at him, because this title reign is probably when he had maybe not the most, but some of the most creative control in his whole career.
Mm. It's a look at a vegan hipster mad with power, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Like, this is like, I think I've said it before on this podcast, right? I'm of the opinion that I think he's the best wrestler of all time, Danielson.
Sure.
But it's interesting looking at the reign and, you know, decisions made during it, and how people can be great creatives, but, you know, there's a reason maybe you have editors or people to say no. Like, he had like two like 60 minute matches before this, right? And he actually had another one like a couple of shows earlier. He had like three basically like 60 minute matches in the space of about 6 weeks, and like none of them need to be 60 minutes having watched them all.
Yeah,
it's interesting how this creative control goes up against what we think of as creative control, which basically boils down to that doesn't work for me, brother.
Yeah.
So quickly, Joe's title reign, which was 645 days, had 30 defenses.
Mm-hmm.
Danielson's, which was over 450 days, had 39 defenses.
Right.
The funny irony is the next match Danielson has after this match was against Kamala.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. I recently saw some of that in a video. It's, yeah.
It's of its time if you say that the time was 15 years before the match actually happened.
Yeah. It's one of those things where it's really fun to be able to say Bryan Danielson defended the title against Kamala. That's a very fun, like, factoid about Bryan Danielson's
career.
It's
more fun if you don't watch it.
The less fun thing is that it actually happened.
I was looking at, because I had Danielson's cage match as well, because I wanted to see how often he had been wrestling kind of before and after, because he has the very serious real injury. And I found an amazing tag match that happened in FIP, so you know it's good because it happened in FIP in front of 8 people. Okay, listen to this. Davey Richards and Roderick Strong versus this absolute dream team in 2006 of Bryan Danielson and Cyber Kong. Which I can't imagine what that looks like.
No, but the 25 people who bought tickets can.
So at this point in Danielson's title reign, we're at the point where there was a lot of hype towards the unified title defense, unification match, no less, against Nigel McGuinness.
Mm-hmm.
And when Danielson got past him, there was a feeling that there were very few people that were possible contenders to beat Danielson, one of whom was Homicide, who was slowly building after his fantastic performance at the end of the RH versus CCW Cage of Death match. So that was where Homicide almost cemented his face turn, especially because the general manager Jim Cornette turned heel against him. And the other guy that basically people thought, oh, this guy might win, that was Kenta. So Kenta had been built a lot. He'd had, I think, 8 matches in ROH this year. His only loss in ROH was because he had Davey Richards as his tag team partner.
His American protege, Davey Richards.
Davey the Anchor Richards.
Yeah.
He won a triple threat with Samoa Joe and Danielson in it.
Mm-hmm.
And Kenta and Marufuji beat Bryan Danielson and Samoa Joe. So
yeah, on paper, that tag match in 2006, put it in my veins.
it's very good. So I rewatched in the build up to this. I rewatched the tag match and I rewatched the three way because I wanted to see their previous interactions leading up to this. And yeah, like I think Kenta pins Bryan in both of them with the go to sleep. The go to sleep is very protected. No one kicks out of it while he's in Ring of Honor. Which plays into the match. A very interesting thing, though, watching those two matches, it feels like the match they are building up is Joe versus Kenta.
Huh.
Joe is like specifically cutting promos on Kenta basically after the match, telling him like, you got lucky, or you pinned Dragon, but you didn't pin me, fuck off, basically. Like, and I think, like, you know, Gabe Sapolsky's booking, you know, there was some good and some bad. I think two matches that are kind of held up as the things that, you know, should have happened but didn't are Samoa Joe and Loki while Joe was champion. And then Joe versus Kenta happening at some point.
Joe versus Kenta one-on-one has never ever happened.
Yeah.
Not even when Hideo Itami became a thing.
Exactly. And people thought it would. Or I wonder, did they think at some point they were going to be able to do a Kobashi rematch? And maybe this was part of that. And also that explains that match, maybe explains in character Joe having the animosity to Kenta.
Mm.
But
the other thing I'd say is The argument was that Samoa Joe was very protective of the ROH title when he was champion and didn't want to lose. But after he lost the title, he still didn't want to lose. And Noah, who were building Kenta up, probably didn't want him to lose. So it kind of feels like one of those matches where it's not happened because no one wants to lose clean and Ring of Honor don't want to have a dusty finish for that kind of match because they know their fan base would shit all over it.
Mm. Yeah, like there's definitely, when you watch 2006, you can definitely see Joe kind of scaling things back a bit in terms of what he does in matches in Ring of Honor, because by that point he's in TNA more and he's getting the big push there.
And by the time you get to, what, March 2007, he's gone from Ring of Honor. He's TNA
all
full time.
The TNA guys all have to, are all pulled out of Ring of Honor. The three-way, at least, is on YouTube, on the official Ring of Honor YouTube channel. And if people want to see a really compelling, similar to this one, a very compelling match where people are getting legit injured, the three-way is fascinating because a few minutes into the match, Samoa Joe knocks out Kenta. He hits him so hard, Kenta goes down, and it's one of those things of, oh, is Kenta selling really well? And then you can see Joe start to pick him up and Kenta not move, and then it seems like he tries to talk to him. Kenta still does not move, and then all of a sudden Joe and Brian are hitting each other and the camera is not on Kenta for a couple of minutes.
Oops.
And a few minutes before that happened, Kenta hit Joe so hard Joe thought his eardrum had burst.
Jesus.
So it's and so everyone gets like concussed in the match. And so things are a bit sloppy and all over the place, but it's fascinating because you've got three world-class wrestlers just giving each other CTE, basically.
Well, it's not a spoiler that three of the four Danielson matches that we discuss on this podcast, someone is either coming into it with a serious injury or coming out of it with a serious injury.
Thankfully, we don't have to worry about Bryan Danielson wrestling injured anymore. He's become
thing of the past. Yeah, sure.
Yeah. We'll get into it, like his physical condition in the match, and I think there's a good conversation about whether or not he should be wrestling. And then I think it is fascinating that like we're like so many years on and he is still wrestling with injuries when he probably shouldn't be wrestling while he has like a broken orbital bone or whatever it is at the minute.
Anything further context-wise to add to this?
Not context, but I want to just quickly touch on the fact I suspected in the build-up to this, I suspected that Bryan Danielson would be the wrestler who had the most nominated matches within one title reign.
Okay.
And he's not.
All right.
He's not far off. He has four matches from this title reign were nominated, which was the Supercard of Honor match against Roderick Strong, the Better Than Our Best match against Lance Storm, the Unified Nigel McGuinness match, which is to come on the podcast, and this match. Two wrestlers did one better. And you can probably guess which wrestlers. Do you want to have a quick guess?
The Okada 2016-2018 reign, right?
Yes. I'll say yes. I don't know the year, but it was Okada's fourth title reign.
Yeah, that makes sense. Is the other one the Kobashi reign? Like 03 to 05?
Nope. It's earlier than that.
A Misawa Triple Crown run?
Nope. Wrong country.
I was going to say, it's going to be something like Shawn Michaels, isn't it?
Or is it Flair in the 80s?
It's Ric Flair's fourth NWA heavyweight title reign. Where he had nominated matches against Dusty Rhodes, Rick Martel, yes, that All Japan match that was quite... Ted DiBiase, Dusty Rhodes again, and Ricky Morton in a cage. The Okada matches were against Marufuji, against Omega, which I believe is to come, against Shibata, which is to come, against Omega again, which is probably to come because I completely lost track of which Okada Omega matches we're doing. And the match where he lost the title at the Dome to Naito, where I was there live and probably can't remember any of it.
Wait, didn't he lose the belt to Kenny?
Oh, did he lose it to Kenny? Oh, no, he beat Naito at 2018, didn't he?
Yeah.
That's how much I can't remember it.
Because I was at the show where he lost the belt to Naito, and that was a different title reign. Yeah.
That was the series finale of New Japan.
That's how memorable it was. All I can remember is my plastic bag flying out of my hands as I left the venue.
That was like the series finale of New Japan, but in the way that they did that extra season of Scrubs where everyone was a teacher and nobody liked it. And that was technically the season finale of Scrubs, right? It's like, yes. This has gone on a little too long.
Yeah. I don't think I ever watched the rest of that season. I think I bailed out of that early.
I think everyone did, and that was the problem.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it was kind of one of those where it was kind of, it was sort of already over, but it's like being at a party and some people still want to keep going, but everyone else is kind of done.
Yeah. So, are we in danger of getting close to talking about the match we're actually here to talk about?
I think we're so much in danger, we're actually going to talk about it.
Good Lord. Right. I'm going to use my power as host to just plow on and say, Bobby Cruz is very lazy, just announcing Kendra's being from Japan, which always annoys the shit out of me. Learn to pronounce one Japanese city, even if it's Tokyo.
I think he's from Tokyo.
So do I.
He's announced him previously as being from Tokyo.
Yeah. As Mark mentioned, you will all be shocked to learn that Bryan Danielson is going in injured. Apparently, it's a pair of muscle tears in his shoulder and potentially a torn pec as well. There is a lot of feeling out to start, and Kenta lays a hard kick into the shoulder early to establish in the room and in the moment why it might be a problem for Danielson going forward. Danielson answers a second one of these with a barrage of slaps from his offhand and a headbutt, but Kenta snapmares him over and I just wrote gets to kicking again to force a retreat and a reset, and Brian has to grab a headlock to basically stop these wild limbs hitting him.
I really like that because it's a good sense of this is how much Danielson knows that he's in trouble, that he needs to get Kenta close.
I just, before we get too deeper into the match, I do want to highlight Bryan Danielson having tape on his shoulder, but he's so pale. It's the same color as him.
I didn't notice. I was going to bring this up. You know how like plasters are supposed to be like flesh color?
Yeah.
Bryan Danielson is the only person I've seen whose flesh is the color of those plasters.
Yeah, it's like you see him like in this match and it's like he's got like weird cellulite on his shoulder. And then he rips it off. God.
My first watch, I didn't actually notice he was wearing tape until commentary pointed it out.
Yeah.
Prazak lists off Bryan's defenses. This is his order, so I don't know if this is the actual order. AJ Styles, Chris Hero, Naomi Shimura Fuji, Homicide, Delirious, Jimmy Yang, Colt Cabana, Nigel McGuinness, Sondre Dutt, Sua, Roderick Strong, Samoa Joe, Chris Daniels, Steve Corino, Chris Sabin, and Lance Storm. If that was a poster with all of those people on, you would buy a ticket in a heartbeat, I think. I would. Certainly in 2006. Good Lord, that's a list of names.
Listen, if in 2023 you told me there was going to be a show where Sua and Steve Corino were wrestling, I would absolutely buy a ticket to that.
You'd go along just for the freak show value.
Yeah.
Hey, especially if they're wrestling each other.
Sua versus Lance Storm? Oh.
Yeah. He would not say many, many skinny boys about Steve Corino. Anyway. Danielson uses holds to keep Kenta down, but as soon as they're forced back up vertical, Kenta gets kicky again and then starts wrenching on the shoulder. Danielson puts a drop kick into his face to take them outside, but Kenta very easily avoids a plunge and then just runs Dragon into the railing shoulder first. We get a lot of mat work with Kenta focusing on the shoulder and Danielson focusing on keeping that shoulder out of Mr. Kobayashi's hands.
Yep.
Danielson is offended by Kenta doing a slingshot version of his cheeky dismissive back heel kick to the face thing. I don't know what to call that. That's the best thing I can describe. Where it looks like he's going to go for a stomp, but he's just like sweeps backwards and boots him in the face.
It's just pure disrespect.
Yeah, it's like a cat covering up litter in a tray, isn't it?
It's this... Because that's kind of the Kenta character, right? Is that he's a really, really cool wrestler and also just a bit of a prick. And I think that makes like this match very unique because...
It's two pricks.
It is. Like, like Danielson is an explicit heel in a in a sympathetic situation.
Yeah.
But he doesn't really change his character. Whereas Kenta is just kind of a broadly unpleasant person, but very cool.
Yes, yeah.
which in wrestling is really all that matters. Yeah. So it is kind of just like pick who you want to root for.
It's the nice bad guy versus the bad nice guy, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like it's not face versus face and it's not heel versus heel. It's like kind of, you know, it's shades of gray, bro. It's and I think it's something that makes this match, like I said, like really unique, where you could kind of pick either. And yeah, I think the match just gives you a lot out of it.
Yeah. I've got written in my notes, I want to praise Danielson's selling, but I don't think that's selling. That's just a man getting kicked very hard in a bad shoulder.
Yeah. He displays his offense at this little kick to the face by just grabbing Kenta's legs from behind and trying to bundle him to it. It's almost like an American football tackle. Just trying to bundle him to the ground. Kenta immediately, though, omoplatas the arm, and Brian has to grab the ropes very quickly.
And I love that because it's kind of... Danielson was the grappler guy. It was like, it was his way out. It was his answer. And Kenta had an answer to Danielson's answer. And it really felt like Danielson was in danger because you're like, oh shit, this is a guy that can keep up with Danielson on the mat and is the better striker.
Danielson gets off some slaps, a headbutt and a sunset flip, but Kenta stuffs that with the loudest of slaps. And goes back to the arm locks, forcing another rope break.
The slap from Kenta off the sunset flip is incredible.
It's
like a gunshot. It's it might be the like one of the best. It's probably the best moment in the match, honestly. I think. If you know, we mentioned before, like in that triple threat, Joe hit him so hard that Kenta was knocked out. It certainly looked here like he was trying to return the favor to the locker room.
Because
he really laid it in.
You're not going to hear many slaps, I think, that are louder.
No. Danielson fashions a comeback with something that should be somebody's finisher, a deadly-looking cravat suplex. He throws in his own mid-kicks and a jumping TNA kick in the corner.
Right on the jaw, no less.
Yes. He goes for a cover off a vertical suplex, but Todd Sinclair won't count because Danielson is leaning on Kenta's throat with his forearm. And was it you or Gadge, Mark, that was yelling at the weekend about the referee making a count while somebody had their knee across their opponent's throat?
That had to be Gadge.
Yeah, he was very wound up about that. Dragon does some, I called it despicable eye raking with the boot laces and running Kenta's eyes across the top rope. He goes for a surfboard, but one of Kenta's legs pops free and some dickhead in the crowd starts chanting that Dragon fucked up. I fucked up, Danielson asks, before very heavily jumping on the backs of Kenta's knees. I don't ever fuck up, he tells the crowd. And the commentator goes, Danielson doesn't ever screw up.
Yeah, it's such a great moment. It's crazy when you see things like that and everyone was always like, oh, Danielson's good in the ring, but he doesn't have charisma or things like that. And you
like the long held, I'm going to put wisdom in inverted commas, was he was a boring little pale man who could wrestle very well.
Yeah.
Like not much was said about his ability to connect with a crowd or his character or his actual charisma.
There's another great one where, like during like a match, I think it's a couple of years before this, where like a fan starts yelling at him to do something or says his match is boring, and he like just turns around and he yells like, who are you to tell me about wrestling? Who the fuck are you to tell me what to do in a wrestling match? And the fan looks like he just wants the ground to swallow him up and looks so uncomfortable. It's like, oh no, the wrestlers can see me.
Yes.
What's ridiculous about this title reign for Danielson, I think it was a lot of it was about him getting that confidence in the character work. Because many of the highlights are probably actually as much character kind of things. It's like Danielson turning on Samoa Joe during like the big ROH versus CCW feud ender. because he doesn't want Joe to have the advantage in an upcoming title match. It's pure petulance. There's like a line on a throwaway weekender in like November of this year where all I remember from that whole show is during a crowd ball, his watch breaks and he goes up to Jimmy Rave and just says, "They broke my watch, Jimmy, the bastards."
Is
this post cape?
Yes.
This is post cape. Right. Yeah. This is post like Jedi looking Danielson with the beard and the cape.
Yeah, it's post cape, but pre eye patch.
Yes. He has so many good lines throughout this title reign. I had a plan to do a podcast that was going to be named after, that was just going to be one of the lines he did. I think part of it as well is it shows the value in wrestlers wrestling in different places, because there's a bit where like he leaves Ring of Honor and it's because he's like doing UK tours.
Yeah.
So he's doing like probably like Butlins and all of those things.
Oh yeah, he did a lot of that in 2003, I do believe.
Yeah. Mm. And when you see him coming back from doing that stuff, it feels like he's got way more of the crowd work and the character stuff down.
Yeah.
You
can tell that Kent has never worked the holiday camps.
Right. And so because of that, like it carries over then when he's doing a very different setting like Ring of Honor. But now he has another tool in his toolbox of doing like really interesting, silly crowd work. And the vibe on a lot of his matches is it feels like he's just sort of wrestling at the start. And it's almost like jazz where he's kind of wrestling until he sees where the mood takes him in the match. And then that's what they decide to go for based on the crowd.
Which is a rare thing in independent wrestling of this time. Because if I think of like early to mid-2000s US independent wrestling, it's a lot of people trying to copy Dragon Gate. It's a lot of people doing spots badly. Brian Danielson was a completely different kind of wrestler at that point.
Yeah.
So, back in this match that we were talking about last week, Kenta's knees are now Brian's target, and he locks in a figure four, and we are treated to possibly the best camera shot I've ever seen out of the intensely workmanlike ROH camera crew.
Oh, it's brilliant.
Brian leans back and Ric Flair grabs the ropes for leverage with one hand either side of the lens, and we get this long, brilliantly framed shot of Danielson's hands, the hold, the ref asking Kenta if he submits, and Kenta screaming in pain and trying to point out to the ref what Brian is doing. Brilliant stuff.
The other thing that's brilliant is maybe the best applied funk spinning toe hold you'll ever see, which was in the build up to the figure four, because he makes it look nasty.
Real quick on the figure four, and this is something I've asked like wrestling fans a lot over the years. Okay, when someone does the figure four, which leg is being hurt, or do you think it's both legs?
It is both. However, I would suggest more of the pressure should be on the underneath leg, because you are pushing the knee
that up,
the wrong way against the fulcrum of the shin going across.
I've always read it as it being worse on the leg that's bent,
right?
Because that's like bending over the other leg.
How many points did Jim Ross used to say it hurt? I can't remember.
I don't know, but it is weird, right? It's like, with the figure four, it kind of doesn't matter which leg you work.
Hold on, let me get Shady Natris or Daniel McCabe back on the line. Let's see if they can tell us what the figure four hurts.
Yeah, hang on, let me DM Parm. But yeah, no, that was just because I was like, he does the spinning toe hold, but then he turns over on the other leg to do the figure four. That was just like an interesting thing that like popped into my
head. Unless it's a Hulk Hogan figure four, in which it hurts nothing.
Yeah. Well, figure four can't hurt you if you have fake knees already. So
no. True. Kenta manages to roll this figure four to the perpendicular ropes for the break, and Brian very loudly tells the referee that he can't get out and he can't release the hold, and he has a massive smile on his face while he's doing it.
It's magnificent. What a shit. Yeah.
It's so funny. It's such a great heel bit. Yeah.
Sinclair tells him to break when he's told to break, and with no provocation, the crowd tell Todd he has till five, referee. Like, Danielson doesn't even have to do anything. He doesn't start it. They do it by themselves. Kenta gets control back, manages a two count off a swan dive drop kick and a double arm suplex before Brian again has to scramble to the ropes to get out of another arm lock. Dragon does his backflip off the corner very slickly into Lance Storm's through the legs into a half crab, which was very, very nice.
A thing about this match is, that I think is great is it feels like you're seeing Brian try a lot of different things, right? Because a lot of his usual stuff isn't working. And it feels like some of that is pulling from like his influences and mentors. Like there's a lot of William Regal, I think, in some of the stuff Brian pulls, right? But it also feels like he's pulling tricks from the people he's beaten in this title reign.
Yes, it's Brian Danielson as Kirby, and I don't mean Martin Kirby. I mean the pink blob that absorbs everybody else's powers.
It is, though. It's like an anime protagonist who has like gone through a whole season fighting people, right? This is the end of the tournament arc. Like the cravat suplex he hits is a Chris Hero move. And he beat Chris Hero. And the he does the Lance Storm crab, and he beat Lance Storm. So it feels like it's like, okay, none of my stuff is normally working, so I'm going to pull out. I'm the best wrestler in the world, though, so I can do everyone else's shit, too.
What's he taking from Delirious?
His regard to his own well-being.
Sure.
Yeah.
Kenta makes an attempt at a go-to-sleep, but Dragon clobbers in with a rolling elbow and a flying forearm in the corner. And it was at this point I noticed the commentary had become commentary for the blind, because they were just saying what was happening. It was, Brian puts Kenta in the corner. Slap across the face. Up he climbs.
The one thing I want to point out quick is the rolling elbow that Danielson does, it's the first and only strikes he throws with his right arm.
Yeah.
The rolling elbow, because he's in so much danger, he instinctively goes for what he knows is his strongest hits. Also, very quickly, there was an earlier bit where Kenta's gone for a fisherman suplex, but he can't get it. So he switches to the... to a target the arm to change Danielson's focus, so then he can switch back and apply a different suplex to get Danielson over. And it's just a lovely bit of change of direction and then coming back to the original direction. And honestly, the kind of stuff I want to see more wrestlers do.
And honestly, the kind of stuff I completely missed. They seem to wait for a bus on the top turnbuckle before Brian delivers a superplex. They're up there for a very long time. When Kenta kicks out, Brian, though, uses it as a chance to lock on the chicken wing. So I guess he's beaten Bob Backlund at some point.
The chicken wing was the move he won the title with. It's what he beat James Gibson with.
Right.
A very big theme that Brian was like very deliberate about in the title reign was, and he's talked about this in general, about not loving the idea of finishers in wrestling. Where like he wants it to feel like a bunch of different things could win a match. So in this title reign, he's won with the crossface chicken wing, cattle mutilation, knocked out people with the rolling elbow.
Small package,
and the like hammer and anvil MMA elbows. Mm-hmm. Like when he did a ref stoppage the first time, no one knew what was happening. Because you didn't see them in pro wrestling.
Yeah.
All sorts of he did a worked shoot with Roderick Strong that ended in like a weird armbar. He's won matches in like eight different ways or whatever.
Yeah.
And then that's not counting like just sort of general bullshit as well as a heel he might pull out. So again, it is really like he is like desperately cloying to find anything he can use in this match.
He hits a perfect diving headbutt to the soles of Kenta's boots, but recovers enough to snipe him out of mid springboard with a dropkick. They have a strike exchange that encompasses slaps, forearms, punches, running kicks to the face, and running leaping headbutts. Danielson hits a German, Kenta hits a release fisherman suplex, and then Brian hits a rolling elbow, and Kenta comes back with a discus lariat, and they both collapse. A Kenta clothesline sends both of them to the floor, where Kenta avoids getting whipped into the railings, but does get an overhead belly-to-belly suplex where he completely misses the mats on the outside and lands on the lovely navy blue office carpet that's on the floor of the Manhattan Center.
When I saw that, it got me thinking, has anyone ever in a match used, like, carpet burn? Like, drag the person on the floor on carpet?
I technically have a scar from an ROH weekend, which is a carpet burn, where someone dragged me across a carpet by my ankle because they thought I wanted tacos.
Was it Kenta?
No.
All right. But, are we going to carry on with this edition of Mark's Weird Wrestling Stories?
Sorry.
No, you can carry on. Is there anything any more to this? Did you get tacos? Were they good? Did you want them?
They were good tacos. Also, segue, unfortunately, this is another weird story. The guy that nearly gets wiped out by Kenta in a second is a friend of mine. And 10 years later, in a different building in New York, he had Kota Ibushi land smack bang on his lap. So he seems to have this bad habit of attracting flying Japanese people.
Oh, that's great. Just take a wrestler home with you.
Exactly. So a baseball slide dropkick sends Kenta over the railing into what I called a lot of white men in their 20s in baseball caps.
Yep.
Most of them backwards.
Into a lot of Ring of Honor students.
And then, yeah, I did note they all had like well-crafted facial hair and were slightly jacked.
Yeah. Rhett Titus earning his keep at this moment. Yeah.
Then with the aid of a springboard, Dragon comes out to join them. Danielson comes back in with a top rope drop kick, but Kenta counters a rolling elbow into a wakigatame right in the middle of the ring. Like, you couldn't get it more perfectly. It's on the O of the logo.
Yeah.
Brian escapes that, backflips out of a back suplex and goes up to the middle rope. And then, truly out of nowhere, Kenta busts out an ace crusher / RKO to counter whatever it is Danielson was going for and goes back to the wakigatame. I don't think I've ever seen Kenta do an ace crusher.
It's funny because it feels so incongruent to most of his moveset. It's a bit like how John Moxley does it now as well.
Where John Moxley fit him, does it?
You know, but then I suppose I like it more when Moxley does it. You're right, if you think about pro wrestling as combat, then it makes sense that, like, well, this is a combat technique.
Yeah.
That's good as a counter.
I'm sure he'd call it a falling cravat anyway.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Danielson blocks a spinning back drop and turns it into the Regal Plex for a two count.
Really smooth transition.
Murdered him on that suplex.
I don't think there's any way to do or take that suplex that doesn't involve near murder.
I think Regal a couple of years ago was very specifically like, stop fucking doing the suplex.
Yeah.
I regret it. I shouldn't have
done
it. But
the difference is Regal's like 6'4 with long arms and Danielson's what, 5'7?
Yeah.
Like, and I know Kenta's not a big guy, but like Regal had like the size to wrap himself around and like the bulk to kind of protect them a bit when he does it. Whereas Danielson doesn't.
It's so gnarly looking.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah. Danielson defiantly tears the tape off his shoulder and hits a perfect back suplex off the top rope.
Mm.
Kenta gets his foot on the ropes to break cattle mutilation and then leaps up to the top to prevent a flying dragon. Danielson dumps him off and then jumps, but Kenta catches him on his shoulders and the Manhattan Center comes to its feet. Go to sleep. Todd Sinclair, the referee, actually counts three, but immediately notices that as he's coming down for the third, that Danielson's foot is on the ropes and waves it off. Masterful. It's the perfect protection of the move, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that pop is what the last 9 or 10 months of Kenta in Ring of Honor have been building to.
Yeah.
No one has kicked out of the move.
One has kicked out the move. Yeah. He got a three count.
Yeah.
And it was only ring positioning that meant it wasn't a win.
And he's pinned Danielson twice with it.
Yeah.
So everyone is waiting for it to happen at some point. And obviously, I'm sure like politics are a part of this as well.
Yeah.
You know, as it always is with interpromotional stuff. But it's so well handled. The pop is so good. The catch by Kenta.
Yeah.
Is amazing. It almost looks like he's going to lose him on it. But like he does a really great job.
Yeah. Kenta pours it on with a Busaiko knee to the back and another one while Brian is slumped in the ropes and then winds up with multiple rope runs to deliver, I would guess, a third for the final blow. Danielson, though, deflects him front first into the ropes and rolls him back into a bridging O'Connor roll for a very close near fall.
Mm.
Brian turns a second go-to-sleep attempt into a crucifix for another two, and fucking Sinclair is counting like his parking meter is running out. That man counts so fast when he gets excited. Danielson hangs on as Kenta rolls out of the pin and traps him face-first down on the mat, almost like the pack brutalizer, the Rings of Saturn, and is laying in the hammer and anvil elbows. and I had to laugh at Kenta repeatedly turning his head to try to pick the lesser of two evils. Do I take elbows in the face or elbows to the back of the head that knock my face into his leg? Ultimately, he gets a whole lot of both.
Yeah.
He powers up, but Dragon forces him back down with another cattle mutilation attempt. Kenta, though, I really like this, rolls over. So he's just laying on Danielson and Danielson's shoulders on the mat. And Dragon has to struggle not to get pinned. It was very clever and looked very close as well. I thought they did this really well. Still holding onto the arms, Brian hits a tiger suplex. And when Kenta rolls his shoulder to break the count, Danielson goes with him, still with the arms clamped, and turns it into cattle mutilation again. He releases it because he can see or sense that Kenta is getting to the ropes with his foot and lays in more elbows. But it's then the third successful application of the cattle mutilation that gets a submission. Mark, do you want to go first?
Yeah, first thing I want to say, for me, that finish was the classic Bryan Danielson finishing stretch of this time, because if you look at it from Danielson getting on Kenta's shoulders for the go to sleep attempt that he escaped from to Kenta tapping out, that is 90 seconds. Danielson does not let go of Kenta. They are in body contact for that whole 90 seconds.
I did say he releases the second cattle mutilation attempt only in as much as he kind of pops out of the bridge and rolls over to deliver more elbows. He still always has at least one of Kenta's arms hooked during that whole period.
So this is a 90 second period of what is essentially, you can argue, is essentially just grappling with strikes with three near falls, two hope spots, multiple momentum changes, and a sense of struggle and a sense of urgency. Yeah. And it's full of counters, but these are earned counters. These are, I absolutely love this finish because it is a style very few people, I think, have ever done. And very few have ever done as well as this. It's, for me, this is the kind of thing that made me love Bryan Danielson of this mid-2000s era. Mm-hmm. It's just great. The thing with this match to me is, in hindsight, a lot of the things that you'd like it for back in the 2000s, you cringe at in terms of it's a great performance for someone with a bad arm. But he really, really should not be wrestling. With that injury, he really should not be wrestling. But I think this match is a fantastic example of both wrestlers at this time in terms of it shows their character work, it shows their personality. It's a good way of, you can sit someone down and they get who Danielson is and they get who Kenta is. They mesh really well. I think it's a fantastic match. I'm not 100% sure if I'd call it must-see. I think before I'd seen it recently, I probably would have called it that because for me, it's one of the two Danielson title reign matches that I would have recommended. But I think, and I would always recommend one, but I honestly need to go and see Unified to try and pick out which of the ones I would nominate. It's a great match. And I think if you haven't seen it, I think people will really enjoy it. And it feels very different to modern wrestling.
Sure. I first saw this as a pandemic watch and I really enjoyed it. And then this time I'm wondering if it was actually their rematch at Driven 2007 I saw, because this didn't land for me this time around this week at all. The technique is all there, as it usually is with these two. I'm going to slightly disagree with Mark, as I don't think Kenta was anything like as dynamic as I was expecting him to be.
Okay.
It didn't feel like I was getting full Kenta in this. The final stretch, everything from the tape coming off to the final bell, I think is excellent.
Yeah.
But my biggest problem with it is that nothing that happens in the first 25 minutes has any bearing on the last five. What's the story? Is it that medical support tape is what is holding Danielson back from doing all his normal stuff? rather than the injury it's supposed to be supporting, because he was doing the Regal Plex, the Tiger Suplex, the elbows, the three cattle mutilations, all with this damaged shoulder, which didn't seem to mean anything.
I'll give you that.
It felt like they did a load of stuff, and then they had 5 minutes that they were definitely going to get in at the end, and just sandwich those two together. It felt like a finishing sequence from a different match.
And also bear in mind that I'd say that this is kind of the era of wrestling where you had the last 5 minutes ignores what comes before. It's a common flaw with a lot of this indie wrestling.
Yes. I suspect a lot of people nominating this are people who saw it at the time and loved it, whereas I'm coming at it from 15 years down the line. This is where Eamon tells me I'm wrong. Go for your life.
Yeah, okay. I understand it. If I was to try to pick out what are like the narrative through lines of the match, I think there is something to the idea of Bryan Danielson overcoming by trying lots of different things, other things, and then realizing he has to power through, taking off the tape, and going back to his own moves rather than keeping to try and pulling from somebody else. So I think there's an idea there, especially, you know, having tried so many different ways to win, realizing that his own stuff, not Lance Storm's, not Regal's, not Chris Hero's, what he specializes in is what gets him through.
Sure.
That 90 seconds grappling sequence at the end, in a way, that's Brian's finisher. Is, you know, hooking the arms at some point, and then it's just a matter of time.
To be clear, I am very much a proponent of anything can finish a match at any time.
Yeah.
I'm not a huge fan of what I've ended up calling finisher pro res. I think people should have signature stuff, and the idea behind the signature stuff is I do this move better than anybody else can. Even if it's, let's say it's a pile driver, it's I know the technique to doing a better pile driver than anybody else. That's why it wins me matches.
Lots of people do DDTs, but Jake Roberts is better for some reason. Yeah,
exactly. Which is why everybody else's is a transitions, but Jake's was the killer one that finished people off. But like people who normally would win with a DDT or a pile driver should also on occasion be able to win by submission or a small package or some other technique.
Yeah, and like I'm just sort of like trying to articulate like the freeform thoughts in my head.
Yeah.
Because to the listeners, I cannot stress how much more prepared Mark and Kieran are for these than I am. they've got notes and everything. I have a much more holistic.
Good God, have you been winging it this whole time?
Oh yeah.
Oh my God.
I've got the autism that lets me remember 2006 Ring of Honor, but not the autism that makes me money, unfortunately. I can talk to you about Bryan Danielson defenses, but I can't count cards.
He's useless in Vegas, but great in the Murphy Rec Center.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, WrestleMania is in Philadelphia this next year. I'm going to be a king. I think a really interesting thing about this match is I think it raises interesting discussions about the idea of selling.
Mm-hmm.
Because Bryan Danielson is actually injured.
Yeah.
Right? So
the day ends in a Y, of course he is.
Yeah, right. But so like, in a way, like, well, if he's actually injured, whatever he does in a way is realistic.
Yeah.
Because the injury is real. And I think it maybe highlights some of the tension when people talk about selling. I know Kenny Omega has talked about this a lot, the idea of like when you're playing a sport and like you get injured, you know, like I've had this happen when I used to play rugby, like you know, like you injure your shoulder or your knee and like you kind of deal with it for a few minutes and then you either work around it or you know it wears off a bit, and sometimes I think with wrestling, like people think, okay, he's done, you know, he's slammed his knee into the ground twice, so he should sell it the whole time. And you know, obviously if it's, you know, they're investing in legwork or arm work for 10 or 15 minutes, then I would want that to be narratively significant, especially in the finish. I think Kenta here I don't know if he always necessarily targets the arm. It's more like the arm isn't so much a target as it is sort of a get out of jail free card for him.
Sure.
I feel like in the match a lot, right?
He kind of does early on, I think, more so yeah, early
he,
on.
He yeah. does early on, and the arm is a good target for him to get out of things Danielson is doing. It's like a good escape plan for him, right? Hmm. When Brian goes to the double leg, he knows he can grab the arm and Brian will have to get out.
Yeah.
So I think there you could also talk about maybe Kenta loses this match because he focuses too much on trying to get like to go to sleep, or the Basaiku knee, which has a big wind up, which then gets countered into the O'Connor roll. And you know, he is trying his main stuff over and over again, whereas Brian is trying lots of different things. So, you know, I think maybe you get into sort of a, again, if we were looking at narrative threads in a match, you could get into kind of breadth versus depth in terms of moveset approaches. And then I think like the real life story of Brian being so badly injured, and again, like Mark said, should not be wrestling realistically. No. It just makes it very compelling. And I think like that is also part of the reason it's so affecting to people, because it's, I think it's an excellent, excellent match. It's an amazing performance by Brian. I think this is the best match of his reign. I know the unified match is higher on the list.
I suspect a lot of people voting for unified were people that were there.
So that's what I think as well.
Yeah.
And maybe they haven't rewatched it in a while.
I mean, Kieran famously has not seen the unified match.
No, and I won't. And I if like clips of it appear in videos I'm watching, I've started turning away as well.
Yeah,
I don't want to see it until we get to it.
Turning away is the reaction a lot of people have.
I know of the legend of the match, and I suspect I will be turning away at certain points during it.
I think so. Obviously, we won't get into the unified match, but sure. I would say I think this is a more consistently good match than the unified match.
Okay. Okay.
Whereas I think the unified match peaks incredibly high, and Kieran, like you, if I had to take a guess at the voter makeup for the people who submitted ballots in for must-see matches, I would guess that there's a lot of like English, European, or people who were probably in the building. And I totally get how, you know, there are certain parts of that match where if you were in the building live, it would be the best thing you ever saw.
Thanks, Eamon. So, you've just given me a job for that episode.
And you were going to do it anyway.
Probably.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Must-see matches, the GDPR edition is going to be coming up.
All right. He's not going to give out actual names on the show.
I have
a bleep button. I used it on Mudge.
Yeah, you guys are going to start a Patreon, and it's just at a certain tier, you guys are going to dox everyone who submitted. It'll be great.
You might joke at that. I was going through a list of like old stuff that I had from years and years ago, and I had a list of people from the ROH message board who were all English with like names and ages, and it's like, okay, I'm deleting that.
Yeah. This reminds me though, I did remember one time I was like, because I don't like Pro Wrestling Tees as a company, and then I think they're awful, but they like had like a data violation like a year ago or something where a bunch of people's info got stolen, and I was like, could I report them to like a European governing body or something just out of spite? You're like, you know what? I'd rather CM Punk than Colt Cabana be in AEW. So this is my revenge, is I'm going to get 1 hour tease or whatever pulled up in European court for GDPR violations. To get back to the match, again, I said at the start, I think Danielson is the best wrestler of all time. So I would consider a lot of his career must see in general on that basis, and then it's then worth watching different eras of his career as well to see how things change and evolve, and no pun intended, obviously, for a couple of matches. It's like watching him here, and he does all these different things, but then within 2 years from this match, I think his ring style would be much more visually dynamic. There'd be a lot more kind of strikes and running and less grappling. And that feels like he's getting ready to transition to TV. Even before he gets signed, you can kind of see it coming. And Kenta is, I would agree, maybe he's better in the Driven match. That match,
I don't know. I will say, I don't know if I've seen that. I'm pretty sure this was the match I saw. I just felt it didn't live up to my memory of it, and I felt let down. I don't think this is bad. It just wasn't what I thought it was going to be, and I felt let down by it.
I can confirm for you that the Driven match is also excellent.
Okay.
And it might be better wrestled.
Okay.
But it doesn't have this kind of extra, the dramatic stakes of like one of the guys probably should be getting surgery.
Yeah.
and in true wrestler fashion, he doesn't get it for like 3 months. and then he comes back and gets his retina detached.
We've covered that one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think Kenta in general, especially the sort of mid-2000s up until his knee injuries start to really take a toll on him, before he gets injured and sort of starts to lose a step, he is such a great wrestler to watch.
And that's why I was disappointed by him here. Like, I didn't feel like I got that.
Yeah, no, I get it. Kenta certainly has better performances. Mm. So does Danielson, right? Especially over the course of his career. Mm. But I think these two have brilliant chemistry against each other. I think they're the two of each other's best opponents. Every time they wrestle, either in America or in Japan, I think they work really well together. I think those matches are always just worth watching anyway, even because I think they match up together very well. I'm not sure what it would be like nowadays, considering the condition Kenta's in, but
I'm sorry, I'm going to put myself on record. I am going to do my damnedest not to watch another Kenta match for the rest of his career, because I had to sit, I did G1 reviews for 3 years straight, and for two of them, I had to watch Kenta in that state, all of his matches in the G1, and my God, I didn't want to see another Kenta match as long as I lived.
Bear in mind, these tournaments also contained Evil.
Yeah, Evil had more variety, for goodness sake. That's how numbing those Kenta matches felt. I get that people like his character. He's just shit in the ring, unfortunately.
He popped up in AEW, and that was good. And I remember liking the Kojima match. That was out of Wrestle Kingdom a couple of years ago. That was good, but yeah, like it's... you have to kind of like pick and choose with Kenta.
You're not getting a cracker a month out of Kenta anymore. Those days are long gone.
It's over his knees, in fairness.
Yes.
And he got like 5 injuries when he was in NXT because like Tino Sabatelli or whoever was like dropping them on his head.
Yeah, I think we brought this up when we talked about previous Kenta matches. I think that also crushed his spirit as well. Like he came out a very different person to he went in. He looked shattered when he came out of WWE. He looked so tired in the face. Like he managed to escape earlier, but he'd been in the Tyler Bate room that just ages you.
Yeah, with WWE developmental, there are 3 things that can happen to you, and 2 of them happen to Kenta. You can get injured a lot by things that are not necessarily your fault. You can get your spirit crushed, and you can get Q-pilled. Now, thankfully, to the best of my knowledge, he has not done the third one.
Yeah.
I'm not going to translate any of his tweets just in case, but I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt. So if you want to see him in better times, maybe remember him how he was, not how he is currently.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is a good window. And then his other stuff in Ring of Honor around this time was also really good. The Loki match from the end of 2005 is a real killer.
We talked about 2 pricks going up against each other. Holy
shit. Oh, boy. That match rules because Kenta kicks out of every one of Loki's finishes. And Loki doesn't get to kick out of anything.
Oh,
it's
fabulous.
Very funny.
Tremendous
stuff. It's a real moment of Loki getting like big dogged by someone else. But yeah, like there's a bunch of fun Kenta stuff. Like, and actually, a thing about this match, they announced Kenta was going to be in next month, which I think is a really important bit for selling him as a possible winner.
Yeah.
because they were like, oh, and Brian is going to wrestle Kenta, and like, there's no announced dates for the next time Kenta's going to be back.
Yeah.
It's like, well, he's obviously going to beat the import. You're like, you know, we all go to shows in Europe. How often have we seen that in Europe and Ireland, right?
Yes.
You know,
I worked for a company for whom that was their business model for a very long time.
Right. That reminds me, I think a really funny bit for someone on your FWA podcast could come on and be like, yeah, man, I love Hayabusa. I love Onita. I think it's an FMW. That would be a really funny gag. So like we've all seen it, right? Like, yeah. Oh, the champion is going to defend against this guy we've brought in.
Yeah.
When's the guy going to be here again? Like,
yeah.
Don't worry about it. It's exactly. Like, well, he's not going to win then.
Yeah.
Because, you know, in theory, unless you're Rev Pro in the mid 2010s, you're not going to give your belt on someone and then have them wrestle in another company for 9 months.
There is a Manchester promotion that had to have their title belt mailed back by an import because the idea was that he'd come back to defend it and he couldn't be bothered to come back and lose.
Fabulous. Wrestling rules. But yeah, and so that's, I think that's a really important part of the match, that like, it's just a great little bit of extra touch saying Kenta, whether he wins or loses, is going to be back anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
And then that gives much more believability to the idea that he could win. Now in the macro sense, Homicide has to really be the person to beat Danielson with how all the booking is gone. But in the moment when Kenta hits the GTS, it really feels like he's going to win the title. So it's like, I think it's one of the great near falls in pro wrestling.
Because they've done the groundwork to build up to it. Yeah. It's not like the import is coming for this one show.
Right.
So he's not going to win.
Yeah, he's wrestled a bunch. He's beaten people who have won the Ring of Honor title previously.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's been extremely dominant. He's beaten their champion twice.
Mm-hmm.
So he has all these things pointing to the fact that he'll probably win, or that he could win, and it's a realistic possibility that he could win. So yeah, and in conclusion, because I sort of feel like I'm rambling now, but I would absolutely recommend the match.
Okay.
Again, I think it's the best match of Danielson's reign. I think the reign is really important as a part of the career of the best wrestler of all time. So as like a informative text for the way he wrestles and how he's evolved, I would certainly recommend the match to people. And it's better than Unified.
All right. I will find out in a few months.
Yeah.
This match got 4.75 stars in the Observer. It currently sits at 9.56 on Cage Match. It came third in the Wrestling Observer poll for Match of the Year 2006. Number two was Kenta versus Marufuji, which we have already covered. And number one was the Dragon Gate Six Man, which we have already covered. Danielson won Most Outstanding Wrestler and Best Technical Wrestler of 2006. If we have nothing more to add, I would very much like to thank Eamon for crawling out front of the floorboards again. I'm going to nail that shut. The floor is now yours to plug whatever you would like to plug, sir.
Yeah, guys, listen, as always, thanks again for having me on. I don't have a huge amount to plug, as usual. You can find me on Twitter at No More Mutants. Or X, as it's also known.
No, it's not.
It's a cool website for straight edge people.
Yes. Or PCO when he first appeared in TNA.
God, that was crazy. He was just, even then, he was taking insane bumps.
Yep.
But I will say every Christmas, I do a wrestling match, Secret Santa. So I'll probably be getting that ready in a couple of weeks. If I don't leave it too late, which has nearly happened before. But this will be like my fourth year doing it. So keep an eye out for that if you'd like to get involved. It's basically just, you'll be given a name and for the person you're giving a match to. And then Christmas Day, I'll send out all the matches in a big thread. So it's, you know, someone gets something at Christmas.
Funny, there was a massive list of matches one could refer to.
I know, right?
To help along such a project.
I've done it for 3 or 4 years now. In that time, I've only ever had to editorialize once when I saw one of the matches. It was like an indie match, and I watched like 5 minutes of it and was like, oh, this is fucking terrible.
Hey, not all Christmas gifts are good. We all received shit. We all got coal in a sock as a kid.
Yeah. What I also do is like I have like a little list of backup matches in case people don't send stuff in. And so this match is actually one of the sort of break glass in case of emergency matches I throw in. That'll be coming up in a couple of weeks. I'm also working on my match of the year list at the minute. That doesn't go up anywhere except my Twitter, but I was very proud of the one I put together last year. So hopefully people will find some interesting stuff in there this year. I might have another podcast appearance coming up soon. I don't want to jinx that because it's not recorded yet. Hopefully it will be getting recorded next week and should be up probably before the end of the week, I would guess.
So follow your Twitter and people will find out.
Exactly. But I'm not going to get specific here in case I jinx things.
All right.
So stay tuned.
Marvelous.
And yeah, thanks again. People should rate and review Must See Matches 5 stars on their podcast platform of choice.
I don't like asking people to do that.
I will. Listen, you guys do this for free. You don't have a Patreon. You don't charge. If people are not rating, you are stealing their labor. And I would be embarrassed and ashamed if I was a freeloader like that. So I think you should do the humane thing and rate Must See Matches positively. Give them 5 stars. Write whatever you want in the comments. That I'll leave up to yourself. But give them 5 stars first.
All right. Thank you very much. You can go to linktr.ee/mustymatches for all the ways to subscribe to the show, links to the full list of matches, and so much more. We are at Musty Matches on Twitter, Instagram, Threads, and Blue Sky. And we have a Discord, bit.ly/mustymatchesdiscord, where you can come and have a chat with us. I am at Kieran Edits on Twitter, and Mark is
at monkey_buckles.
As Eamon referred to, I also have a second side project, and podcast about the FWA, the Frontier Wrestling Alliance, and everything they ever put on television. Myself, Andy Ogden, and Eddie Sideburns gang up once a month for a show called Nothing and Like It, where we review swathes of FWA television. The second episode has been recorded and will go up a couple of days after this comes out. You can go to linktr.ee/FWApod for the socials and how to subscribe to that. Next week, Eamon goes back under the floorboards and we get Matty Edwards out of his box in the loft for the Triple H versus Cactus Jack street fight from Royal Rumble 2000. Make sure you're here for that. Thank you very much for listening and goodbye.